radiation emanated from the pool, and on its surface bobbed a dead bird the size of a finch, floating in a corona of molting feathers. "Bomb crater," Bond muttered. The bomb crater was an American footprint, a sign that we had entered Laos. We came upon more of these craters as we journeyed east, sometimes singly, sometimes in clusters, and we had to pick our way carefully past the Julian remnants of unrooted cagefoots flung this way and that. Once we came close to a village, and on the banks of the craters nearby, we saw nets on poles, ready to be dipped into these pools that the farmers had stocked with fish. Near dawn, the grizzled captain halted our trek at a spot the Lao farmer said was isolated and rarely visited by the inhabitants of this borderland. Our resting place was on the peak of a hill, and under the indifferent cagefoots we spread our ponchos and covered ourselves with hooded capes of netting into which we had woven palm fronds. I lay down with my head on my rucksack, which, beside my rations, contained Asian communism and the Oriental mode of destruction, tucked away in my rucksack's false bottom in case I ever needed it again. Two or three of us stayed awake for shifts of 3 hours, and it was my misfortune to be assigned to one of the middle shifts. It seemed that I had barely managed to fall asleep with the brim of my hat on my face when the hefty machine gunner shook my shoulder and exhaled his horrendous bacterial breath all over my face, informing me that it was my turn for sentry duty. The sun was high in the sky, and my throat was parched. I could see the Mekong in the far distance through my binoculars, a brown belt dividing the earth's green torso. I could see question marks and exclamation points of wood smoke issuing from farmhouses and brick factories. I could see bare-shinned farmers wading after their water buffaloes, fetlocked deep in the muddy water of rice paddies. I could see countryside roads and paths, trafficked by vehicles that, from a distance, moved with the tortured slowness of arthritic turtles. I could see crumbling sandstone ruins of an ancient temple, erected long ago by some fallen race, overseen by the crowned head of some forgotten tyrant, blank eyes blinded by the waste of his empire. I could see the entire lay of the land, naked body exposed in sunlight, and resembling not at all the mysterious creature of night. And suddenly a tremendous longing seized me with such force that the land itself lost focus and trembled, and I realized, with equal parts amazement and dread, that for all the essentials we had brought with us, none of us had brought a drop of liquor. The second night did not proceed much as the first. It was not clear to me whether I walked that night or whether I simply hung on to a beast bucking and heaving under me. A tide of bile rose and fell in my throat, my ears swelled from my head, and I shivered as if it were winter time. When I looked up, I caught a glimpse of the stars through the branches, swirling snowflakes trapped within the glass of a snow globe. Sunny and the crapulent major laughed faintly as they watched me from outside that snow globe and shook it with their giant hands. The only solid thing anchoring me to the material world was the rifle in my hands, for my feet could not feel the ground. I gripped the AK-47 as I had Lana's arms the night after I had left Sunny's place. She had not looked surprised on opening the door, for she had always known I was coming back. I had not told the general what Lana and I had done, but I should have. There was one thing he could never do, and I had done it. For having just killed a man, nothing was forbidden from me, not even what belonged to or issued from him. Even the scent of the forest was her scent, and when I shrugged off my rucksack and sat down between Bond and the effectless lieutenant in the midst of a bamboo grove, the dampness of the earth reminded me of her. Above us, innumerable fireflies lit the branches, and I had the sense that the snouts and eyes of the forest were fixed upon us. Some animals could see in the dark, but there was only humans who deliberately sought out every possible route into the darkness of our own interiors. As a species, we had never encountered a cave, a door, or an entrance of any kind that we did not want to enter. We are never satisfied with only one way in. We will always try every possibility, even the blackest and most forbidding passages. Or so I was reminded in my night with Lana. "I gotta pee," said the effectless lieutenant, standing up again. He disappeared into the gloom of the forest, while above him the fireflies turned off and on in unison. "You know why I like you?" she had asked in the aftermath. "You're everything my mother would hate." I was not offended. I had been force-fed so much heat that a little more hardly mattered to my fattened liver. If my enemies ever cut out my liver and ate it, as the Cambodians were rumored to do, they would smack their lips in delight, for nothing was more delicious than the foie gras of hatred, once one had acquired the taste for it. I heard the crack of a branch in the direction taken by the lieutenant. "Are you okay?" Bond said. I nodded, concentrating on the fireflies, their collective signal outlining the shapes of the bamboo trees in a wilderness Christmas. The underbrush rustled, and the dim shape of the lieutenant emerged from the bamboo. "Hey," he said, "I—" A flash of light and sound blinded and deafened me. Earth and gravel pelted me, and I flinched. My ears rang, and somebody was screaming as I huddled on the ground, arms over my head. Somebody was screaming, and it was not me. Somebody was cursing, and it was not me. I shook off the earth that had fallen onto my face, and overhead the trees had gone dark. The fireflies had stopped blinking, and somebody was screaming. It was the effectless lieutenant, writhing in the ferns. The philosophical medic bumped against me as he sprinted to reach the lieutenant. Looming out of the darkness, the grizzled captain said, "Take up your defensive positions, goddammit!" Beside me, Bond turned his back to the mess, racked his slide, click-clack, and aimed his weapon into the darkness. I heard the click-clack all around me of weapons being primed for firing, and I did the same. Someone turned on a flashlight, and even with my back turned to the scene, I could see its luminescence. "Legs gone," said the philosophical medic. The lieutenant kept on screaming, "Hold the light while I tie him off." "Everybody in the valley's hearing this," said the dark marine. "Is he going to make it?" said the grizzled captain. "He might make it if we get him to a hospital," said the medic. "Hold him down." "We have to shut him up," said the dark marine. "It must have been a mine," said the grizzled captain. "It's not an attack." "Either you do it or I do it," said the dark marine. Someone put his hand on the lieutenant's mouth, muffling his screams. Looking over my shoulder, I saw the dark marine's flashlight illuminating the philosophical medic as he pointlessly tied the tourniquet on the lieutenant's stump, the molar of a bone protruding where the leg had been blown off above the knee. The grizzled captain had one hand clapped over the lieutenant's mouth, his other hand squeezing shut the nostrils. The lieutenant heaved, clutching at the sleeves of the philosophical medic and the grizzled captain, and the dark marine switched off the flashlight. Gradually, the thrashing and strangled noises ceased, and at last he was still, dead. But if he was really gone, why could I still hear him screaming? "We have to move," said the dark marine. "No one's coming now, but they will when it's light." The grizzled captain said nothing. "Did you hear me?" The grizzled captain said yes. "Then do something," said the dark marine. "We gotta be as far away from here as possible before morning." The grizzled captain said to bury him. When the dark marine said that was going to take too long, the grizzled captain gave the order to carry the body with us. We divvied up the lieutenant's ammunition and gave his rucksack to the Lao farmer, with the dark marine carrying the lieutenant's M-16. The hefty machine gunner handed his M-60 to the darker marine and picked up the lieutenant's body. We were about to set off when the gunner said, "Where's his leg?" The dark marine turned on his flashlight. There the leg lay, served on a bed of shredded ferns, meat tattered and strips of black cloth still clinging to it, mangled white bone jutting through a jagged rip in the flesh. "Where's the foot?" said the dark marine. "I think it was just blown away," said the philosophical medic. Bits of pink flesh and skin and tissue hung on the ferns, already crawling with ants. The dark marine grabbed the leg, and when he looked up, I was the first one he saw. "It's all yours," he said, thrusting the leg at me. I thought about refusing it, but someone else would have to carry it. "Remember, you're not half of anything. You're twice of everything. If someone else had to do this, I could too." It was only a hunk of meat and bone, its flesh sticky with blood and gritty with embedded dirt. When I took it and brushed off the ants, I found it to be a little heavier than my AK-47, the leg having been detached from a smallish man. The grizzled captain ordered us to march, and I followed the hefty gunner, the lieutenant's body slung over his shoulder. The lieutenant's shirt had ridden up his back, and the exposed flank of flesh was blue in the moonlight. I carried his leg with one hand, my other hand on the strap of the AK-47 hanging from my shoulder, and the burden of carrying a man's leg seemed far heavier than carrying a man's body. I carried his leg as far away from me as possible, its weight growing more and more, like the Bible my father made me hold in front of the classroom as punishment for some transgression, my arm outstretched with a book on the scale of my hand. I carry that memory still, along with the memory of my father in his coffin, corpse as white as the affected lieutenant's protruding bone. The chanting of the congregation in the church hummed in my ears. I had learned of my father's death when his deacon called me at police headquarters. "How did you get this phone number?" I said. "It was in the father's papers on his desk." I looked at the document on my own desk, a classified investigation about an unremarkable event last year, 1968, when an American platoon had pacified a mostly abandoned village near Quang Mai. After executing the water buffaloes, pigs, and dogs, and after gang-raping four girls, the soldiers had gathered them, as well as 15 elders, women, and children, in the village square where they fired on them until they were dead, according to a regretful private's testimony. The platoon leader's report certified that his men had killed 19 Viet Cong, although they had recovered no weapons besides some spades, some hoes, a crossbow, and a musket. "I don't have time," I said. "It would be important for you to go," said the deacon. "Why would it be important?" I said. After a long pause, the deacon said, "You were important to him, and he was important to you." It was then I knew, without any need for words, that the deacon was aware of who my father was. We ended our forced march after 2 hours, the same amount of time devoted to my father's funeral mass. A creek gurgled in the arroyo where we stopped, and where I scratched my face against a vine of bougainvillea. I set down the leg as the Marines began digging a shallow grave. My hand was gummy with blood, and I knelt by the creek to wash it in the cold water. By the time the Marines finished, my hand was dry, and a faint stroke of pink light was on the horizon. The grizzled captain unrolled the effectless lieutenant's cape of palm leaves, and the hefty machine gunner laid his body on it. I only realized then that I would have to bloody my hand again. I picked up the leg and put it in its place. In the pink light, I saw his open eyes and slack mouth, and I could still hear him screaming. The grizzled captain closed the eyes and mouth and wrapped his body in the cape, but when he and the hefty machine gunner lifted the body, the leg slipped out of the cape. I was already wiping my sticky hands on my pants, but there was nothing to do but pick up the leg once more. After his body was lowered into the grave, I leaned in and tucked his leg under the cape, below his knee. Glistening worms were already wriggling out of the earth as I helped scoop dirt back into the grave. It was just deep enough to cover our tracks for a day or two, until the animals dug up the corpse and ate it. "What I want to know," said Sonny, squatting by me as I knelt by the grave, "is whether the lieutenant will hang around here with one leg or two, or whether he'll have worms crawling out of his eyes or not." "Truly," said the crapulent major, head sticking out of the grave as he talked to me, "it's a mystery what shape a ghost will take. Why am I all here except for this hole in my head, and not a disgusting mess of bones and meat? Tell me that, won't you, Captain? You know everything about everything, don't you?" I would have answered if I could, but it was hard to do so when I felt that I, too, had a hole in my head. The day passed with us undiscovered, and by late in the evening, after a short march, we reached the banks of the Mekong, gleaming under the moonlight. Somewhere on the other side, you were waiting for me, Commandant, as well as the faceless man who is the Commissar. While I was still innocent of this knowledge, it was impossible not to sense something foreboding as we plucked off the leeches adhering to us with the stubbornness of bad memories. We had been carrying them without knowing, until the Lao farmer pulled an animated black finger from his ankle. I could not help but wish, prying away a little monster sucking my leg, that it was Lana thus attached to me. The skinny RTO radioed the base camp, and while the grizzled captain reported to the admiral, the Marines again showed they were good for something by constructing a raft of bamboo trunks strapped together with lianas. Four men could row themselves across the river with makeshift paddles fashioned of bamboo, with the first team trailing a rope carried by the darker Marine. That rope, tied to a tree on either side of the river, would guide the darker Marine on his return with the raft. It would take four trips to transport all of us, and the first group set off before midnight. The darker Marine, the Hmong scout, the hefty machine gunner, and the dark Marine. The rest of us were scattered on the exposed bank, huddled under our capes of leaves, backs to the river, and weapons aimed at the vast forest crouched on its haunches. A half hour later, the darker marine returned with the raft. Three more went with him. The Lao farmer, the darkest marine, and the philosophical medic, who, at the effectless lieutenant's grave, had said as a kind of benediction, "All of us who are living are dying. The only ones not dying are the dead." "What the hell does that mean?" said the dark marine. I knew what it meant. My mother was not dying because she was dead. My father was also not dying because he was dead. But I was on this embankment, dying, because I was not yet dead. "What are we, then?" asked Sonny and the crapulent major. "Dying or dead?" I shivered and gazed into the darkness of the forest, staring down the length of my weapon. I saw the shapes of other ghosts among the haunted trees. Human ghosts and beast ghosts, plant ghosts and insect ghosts, the spirits of dead tigers and bats and cycads and hobgoblins, vegetable world and animal world heaving with claims to the afterlife as well. The entire forest shimmered with the antics of death the comedian and life the straight man, a duo that would never break up. To live was to be haunted by the inevitability of one's own decay, and to be dead was to be haunted by the memory of living. "Hey," hissed the grizzled captain, "it's your turn." Another half hour must have passed. The raft was scraping onto the bank again, pulled along the rope by the darker marine. Vaughn and I rose, along with Sonny and the crapulent major, ready to follow me across the river. I remember the river's white noise, the soreness of my knees and the weight of my weapon in my arms. I remember the injustice of how my mother never came to visit me after her death, no matter how many times I cried out for her, unlike Sonny and the crapulent major, whom I would carry with me forever. I remember how none of us looked human on the riverbank, shrouded by our capes of leaves, our faces painted black, clutching weapons extracted from the mineral world. I remember the grizzled captain saying, "Take the paddle," as he thrust it at me, right before a whip snapped by my ear and the grizzled captain's head cracked open, spilling its yolk. A fleck of something wet and soft landed on my cheek, and a thunderous racket rose on both sides of the river. Muzzle flashes rippled on the far side, and the boom of grenades rent the air. The darker marine had taken one step off the raft when a rocket-propelled grenade whooshed by me and struck the raft, shattering it in a hail of fire and sparks and throwing him into the shallow water lapping against the riverbank, where he lay, not quite dead, screaming. "Get down, dumbass!" Bond pulled me to the earth. The skinny RTO was already returning fire into our side of the forest, the sound of his submachine gun hammering my eardrums. I could feel the volume of the guns and the velocity of the bullets passing overhead. Fear inflated the balloon of my heart, and I pressed my cheek into the earth. Being on the bank's downward slope saved us from the ambuscade, keeping us below the eyeline sight of the forest's vengeful ghost. "Shoot, goddammit," said Bond. Dozens of insane, murderous fireflies flickered on and off in the forest, only they were muzzle flashes. To shoot, I would have to lift my head and take aim, but the guns were loud and I could feel their bullets striking the earth. "Shoot, goddammit!" I lifted my weapon and aimed it into the forest, and when I squeezed the trigger, the gun kicked me in the shoulder. The muzzle flash was so bright in the darkness that everyone who was trying to kill us now knew exactly where I was. But the only thing to do was to keep squeezing the trigger. My shoulder was hurting from the gun kicking me, and when I paused to eject a magazine and load another, I could feel my ears aching as well, subjected to the stereophonic effects of our firefight on this side of the river and the clash of the ignorant squads on the other side. At that moment, I feared that Bond would rise and order me to charge with him into the enemy's fire, and I knew that I would not be able to do it. I feared death, and I loved life. I yearned to live long enough to smoke one more cigarette, drink one more drink, experience 7 more seconds of obscene bliss, and then, perhaps, but most likely not, I could die. All of a sudden, they stopped shooting at us, and it was just Bond and me blasting at the darkness. Only then did I notice that the skinny RTO was no longer joining in. I paused once more in my shooting and saw, under the moonlight, his head bowed over his silent gun. Bond was the only one still firing, and after discharging the last of his magazine, he too stopped. The firefight across the river had already ceased, and from the other side a few men were shouting in a foreign language. Then, from the recesses of the gloomy forest on our side, someone called out in our language, "Give up! Don't die for nothing!" His accent was northern. All was quiet on the riverbank except for the river's throaty whisper. No one was screaming for his mother, and it was then I knew that the darker marine was also dead. I turned to Bon, and in the lunar light I saw the whites of his eyes as he looked at me, wet with the sheen of tears. "If it wasn't for you, you stupid bastard," Bon said, "I'd die here." He was crying for only the third time since I had known him, not in that apocalyptic rage when his wife and son died, or in the sorrowful mood that he shared with Lana, but quietly, in defeat. The mission was over, he was alive, and my plot had worked, no matter how clumsily or inadvertently. I had succeeded in saving him, but only, as it turned out, from death. Chapter 19. Only from death. The commandant appeared genuinely wounded, his finger resting on the last words of my confession. In his other hand was a blue pencil, the color chosen because Stalin had also used a blue pencil, or so he told me. Like Stalin, the commandant was a diligent editor, always ready to note my many errata and aggressions, and always urging me to delete, excise, reword, or add. Implying that life in my camp is worse than death is a little histrionic, don't you think? The commandant seemed eminently reasonable, as he sat in his bamboo chair, and for a moment, sitting in my bamboo chair, I too felt he was eminently reasonable. But then I remembered that only an hour earlier, I had been sitting in the windowless, red-brick isolation cell, where I had spent the last year since the ambush, rewriting the many versions of my confession, the latest of which the commandant now possessed. "Perhaps your perspective differs from mine, Comrade Commandant," I said, trying to get used to the sound of my own voice. I had not spoken to anyone in a week. "I am a prisoner," I went on, "and you're the one in charge. It may be hard for you to sympathize with me, and vice versa." The commandant sighed and laid the final sheet of my confession on top of the 294 other pages that preceded it, stacked on a table by his chair. "How many times must I tell you? You're not a prisoner." "Those men are prisoners," he said, pointing out the window to the barracks that housed 1,000 inmates, including my fellow survivors, the Lao farmer, the Hmong scout, the philosophical medic, the darkest marine, the dark marine, and Bon. "You are a special case." He lit a cigarette. "You are a guest of myself and the Commissar." "Guests can leave, Comrade Commandant." I paused to observe his reaction. I wanted one of his cigarettes, which I would not get if I angered him. Today, however, he was in a rare good mood and did not frown. He had the high cheekbones and delicate features of an opera singer, and even 10 years of warfare fought from a cave in Laos had not ruined his classically good looks. What rendered him unattractive at times was his moroseness, a perpetual, damp affliction he shared with everyone else in the camp, including myself. This was the sadness felt by homesick soldiers and prisoners, a sweating that never ceased, absorbed into a perpetually damp clothing that could never be dried, just as I was not dry, sitting in my bamboo chair. The commandant had at least the benefit of an electric fan blowing on him, one of only two in the camp. According to my baby-faced guard, the other fan was in the commissar's quarters. "Perhaps a better term than guest is patient," the commandant said, editing once more. "You have traveled to strange lands and been exposed to some dangerous ideas. It wouldn't do to bring infectious ideas into a country unused to them. Think of the people, insulated for so long from foreign ideas. Exposure could lead to a real catastrophe for minds that aren't ready for them. If you saw the situation from our point of view, you would see that it was necessary to quarantine you until we could cure you, even if it hurts us to see a revolutionary like yourself kept in such conditions." I could see his point of view, albeit with some difficulty. There were reasons to be suspicious of someone like me, who had endured suspicion all his life. But still, it was hard for me not to feel that a year in an isolation cell from which I was allowed to emerge only an hour a day for exercise blinking and white, was unwarranted, as I had informed him at each of these weekly sessions, where he criticized my confession and I, in turn, criticized myself. These reminders I had given him must also have been on his mind, because when I opened my mouth to speak again, he said, "I know what you're going to say. As I told you all along, when your confession reaches a satisfactory state, based on our reading of it and on my reports of the self-criticism sessions to the commissar, you will move on to the next, and we hope, last stage of your re-education. In short, the commissar believes you ready to be cured." He does. I had yet to even meet the faceless man, otherwise known as the commissar. None of the prisoners had. They saw him only during his weekly lectures, sitting behind a table on the dais of the meeting hall, where all the prisoners gathered for political lectures. I had not even seen him there, for these lectures, according to the commandant, amounted only to an elementary school education designed for pure reactionaries, puppets brainwashed by decades of ideological saturation. The faceless man had decreed me exempt from these simple lessons. Instead, I was privileged by having no burdens except to write and to reflect. My only glimpses of the commissar had come on those rare moments when I looked up from my exercise pen and saw him on the balcony of his bamboo quarters, atop the larger of the two hills overlooking the camp. At the base of the hills clustered the kitchen, mess hall, armory, latrines, and warehouses of the guards, along with the solitary rooms for special cases like me. Barbed wire fencing separated this interior camp of the guards from the exterior camps where the inmates slowly eroded. The former soldiers, security officers, or bureaucrats of the defeated regime. Next to one of the gates in this fencing, on the interior side, was a pavilion for family visits. The prisoners had become emotional cacti in order to survive, but their wives and children inevitably wept at the sight of their husbands and fathers, whom they saw, at most, a couple of times a year, the trek from even the nearest city, an arduous one involving train, bus, and motorbike. Beyond the pavilion, the exterior camp itself was fenced off from the wasteland of barren plains surrounding us. The fence demarcated with watchtowers where pith-helmeted guards with binoculars could observe female visitors and, according to the prisoners, entertain themselves. From the elevated height of the commandant's patio, one could see not only these voyeurs, but also the crated plains and denuded trees surrounding the camp, a forest of toothpicks over which gusts of crows and torrents of bats soared in ominous black formations. I always paused on the patio before entering his quarters, savoring for a moment the view denied me in my isolation cell, where, if I had not yet been cured, I had certainly been baked by the tropical sun. "You have complained often about the duration of your visit," the commandant said, "but your confession is the necessary prelude to the cure. It is not my fault that it took you a year to write this confession, one that is not, in my opinion, even very good. Everyone, except you, has confessed to being a puppet soldier, an imperialist lackey, a brainwashed stooge, a colonized comprador, or a treacherous henchman. Regardless of what you think of my intellectual capacities, I know they're just telling me what I want to hear. You, on the other hand, won't tell me what I want to hear. Does that make you very smart or very stupid?" I was still somewhat dazed, the bamboo floor wobbling under my bamboo seat. It always took me at least an hour to become readjusted to light and space after my cell's cramped darkness. "Well," I said, gathering the tattered coat of my wits about me, "I believe the unexamined life is not worth living. So thank you, Comrade Commandant, for giving me the opportunity to examine my life." He nodded approvingly. "No one else has the luxury I have of simply writing and living the life of the mind," I said. My orphaned voice, which had detached itself in my cell and spoken to me from a cobweb corner, had returned. "I am smart in some ways, stupid in others. For example, I am smart enough to take your criticism and editorial suggestions seriously, but I am too stupid to understand how my confession has not met your high standards, despite my many drafts." The commandant regarded me through glasses that magnified his eyes to twice their size, his poor eyesight a condition of having lived in cavernous darkness for 10 years. If your confession was even just satisfactory, the Commissar would let you proceed with what he calls your oral examination, he said. But my opinion of what he calls your written examination is that it hardly seems like a genuine confession to me. Haven't I confessed to many things, Commandant? In content, perhaps, but not in style. Confessions are as much about style as content, as the Red Guards have shown us. All we ask for is a certain way with words. Cigarette? I hid my relief and merely nodded casually. The Commandant inserted the dart of a cigarette between my cracked lips, then lit it for me with my own lighter, which he had appropriated. I inhaled the oxygen of smoke, its infusion into the folds of my lungs, calming the trembling in my hands. Even in this latest version, you quote Ngoho only once. This is but one symptom, among many in your confession, that you prefer foreign intellectuals and culture over our native traditions. Why is that? I'm contaminated by the West? Exactly. That wasn't so hard to admit, was it? Funny, then, how you can't put it into writing. Of course, I can understand why you didn't quote how the steel was tempered or tracks in the snowy forest. You wouldn't have had access to them, even though every one of my generation from the North has read them, not to mention Tohu, our greatest revolutionary poet, and to cite instead the yellow music of Famdui and the Beatles. The Commissar actually has a collection of yellow music that he keeps for what he calls research purposes. He's offered to let me listen to them, but no thanks. Why would I want to be contaminated by that decadence? Contrast the songs you discussed to Tohu's Since Then, which I read in high school. He talks about how the sun of truth shone on my heart, which was exactly how I felt about the revolution's effect on me. I carried a book of his with me to China for infantry training, and it helped sustain me. My hope is that the sun of truth will shine on you as well. But I also think of another poem of his about a rich child and a servant child. Closing his eyes, the Commandant recited a stanza. A child lives in a life of plenty with abundant toys made in the West, while the other child is an onlooker, watching silently from far away. He opened his eyes. Worth a mention, don't you think? If you would give me that book, I'd read it, I said, not having read anything for a year besides my own words. The Commandant shook his head. You won't have any time to read anything in the next phase. But implying you only needed a book in order to be better read is hardly a good defense. Not quoting Uncle Ho or revolutionary poetry is one thing, but not even a folk saying or a proverb. Now, you may be from the South. I was born in the North and lived 9 years there, sir. You chose the Southern side. Regardless, you share a common culture with me, a Northerner, yet you will not quote from that culture, not even this. The good deeds of father are as great as Mount Taisun. The virtue of mother is as bountiful as spring water gushing from its source. Wholeheartedly is mother to be revered and father respected, so that the child's way may be accomplished. Did you not learn something as basic as this in school? My mother did teach it to me, I said, but my confession does show my reverence for my mother and why my father is not to be respected. The relations between your mother and father are indeed unfortunate. Now, you may think that I am heartless, but I am not. I look at your situation and feel great sympathy for you, given your curse. How can a child be accomplished if his source is tainted? Yet I can't help but feel that our own culture, and not Western culture, tells us something about your difficult situation. Talent and destiny are apt to feud. Don't you think Wendu's words apply to you? Your destiny is being a bastard, while your talent, as you say, is seeing from two sides. You would be better off if you only saw things from one side. The only cure for being a bastard is to take a side. You're right, Comrade Commandant, I said, and perhaps he was. But the only thing harder than knowing the right thing to do, I went on, is to actually do the right thing. I agree. What puzzles me is that you are perfectly reasonable in person, but on the page, you are recalcitrant. The Commandant poured himself a shot of unfiltered rice wine from a recycled soda bottle. Any urges? I shook my head, even though my priapic desire for a drink bumped against the back of my throat. Tea, please, I said, voice cracking. The commandant poured me a cup of lukewarm, tinted water. It was quite sad watching you in those first few weeks. You were a raving lunatic. Isolation did you good. Now you're purified, at least in body. If spirits are so bad for me, why do you drink, commandant? I don't drink to excess, unlike you. I disciplined myself during the war. You rethink your entire life living in a cave, even things like what to do with one's waste. Never thought of that? Once in a while. I sense sarcasm. Still not satisfied with the camp's amenities and your chamber? This is nothing compared to what I went through in Laos. That's why I'm also puzzled by the unhappiness of some of our guests. You think I'm feigning perplexity, but no, I'm genuinely surprised. We haven't stuck them in a box underground. We haven't shackled them until their legs waste away. We haven't poured lime on their heads and beaten them bloody. Instead, we let them farm their own food, build their own homes, breathe fresh air, see sunlight, and work to transform this countryside. Compare that to how their American allies poisoned this place. No trees, nothing grows. Unexploded mines and bombs killing and maiming innocents. This used to be beautiful countryside, now it's just a wasteland. I try to bring these comparisons up with our guests, and I can see the disbelief in their eyes even as they agree with me. You, at least, are honest with me, even though, to be honest with you, that may not be the healthiest strategy. I've lived my life underground for the revolution, commandant. The least the revolution can grant me is the right to live above ground and be absolutely honest about what I have done, at least before you put me below ground again. There you go again, defiant for no reason. Don't you see we live in a sensitive time? It will take decades for the revolution to rebuild our country. Absolute honesty isn't always appreciated at moments like this, but that's why I keep this here. He pointed at the jar on the bamboo cabinet, covered with a jute cloth. He had already shown the jar to me more than once, though once was more than enough. Nevertheless, he leaned over and slipped the cloth off the jar, and there was nothing to do but turn my gaze onto the exhibit that should, if there were any justice in the world, be exhibited in the Louvre and other great museums devoted to Western accomplishments. Floating in formaldehyde was a greenish monstrosity that appeared to have originated from outer space, or the deepest, weirdest depths of the ocean. A chemical defoliant invented by an American Frankenstein had led to this naked, pickled baby with one body but two heads, four eyes shut but two mouths agape in permanent, mongoloid yawns. Two faces pointed in different directions, two hands curled up against the chest, and two legs spread to reveal the boiled peanut of the masculine sex. Imagine what the mother felt. The commandant tapped his finger on the glass. Or the father. Imagine the shrieks. What is that thing? He shook his head and drank his rice wine, its color that of thin milk. I licked my lips, and while the scratching of my desiccated tongue on my brittle lips was loud in my ears, the commandant did not notice. We could have just shot all these prisoners, he said. Your friend Bond, for example. A Phoenix Program assassin deserves the firing squad. Protecting him and excusing him as you do reflects poorly on your character and judgment. But the Commissar is merciful and believes anyone can be rehabilitated, even when they and their American masters killed anyone they wanted. In contrast to the Americans and their puppets, our revolution has shown generosity by giving them this chance for redemption through labor. Many of these so-called leaders never worked a day on a farm. How do you lead an agricultural society into the future with no idea of the peasant's life? Without bothering to drape the cloth over the jar again, he poured himself another drink. Lack of understanding is the only way to characterize how some prisoners think they're being poorly fed. Of course I know they suffer, but we all suffered. We all must suffer still. The country is healing, and that takes longer than the war itself. But these prisoners focus only on their own suffering. They ignore what our side went through. I can't get them to understand that they get more calories per day than the revolutionary soldier during the war, more than the peasants forced into refugee camps. They believe they are being victimized here instead of being re-educated. This obstinacy shows how much re-education they still need. As recalcitrant as you are still far ahead of them. Here, I agree with the Commissar about the state of your re-education. I was just talking about you with him the other day. He's remarkably tolerant of you. He didn't even object to being called the faceless man. No, I understand. You're not mocking him, merely describing the obvious. But he's quite sensitive about his condition. But wouldn't you be? He wants to meet you this evening. That's quite an honor. No prisoner has ever met him personally. Not that you are a prisoner. He wants to clarify a few issues with you. What issues? I said. We both looked at my manuscript, its leaves neatly stacked on his bamboo table and pinned down by a small rock. All 295 pages written by the light of a wick floating in a cup of oil. The commandant tapped my pages with a middle finger, its tip cut off. What issues? He said. Where to begin? Ah, dinner. A guard was at the door with a bamboo tray. A boy, his skin a sickly shade of yellow. Whether they were guards or prisoners, most men in the camp were this shade of yellow, or else a sickly, rotten shade of green, or a sickly, deathly shade of gray, a color palette resulting from tropical illnesses and a calamitous diet. What is it? Said the commandant. Wood pigeon, manioc soup, stir-fried cabbage, and rice, sir. The wood pigeon's roasted haunches and breast made me salivate, as my usual ration was boiled manioc. Even when starving, I had to force the manioc down my gullet, where it cemented itself against the walls of my stomach, laughing at my attempts to digest it. Subsisting on a diet of manioc not only was culinarily unpleasant, it was also no fun from a gastroenterological perspective, resulting in either a painfully solid brick or its highly explosive liquid opposite. As a consequence, the inflamed piranha of one's anus was always gnawing at one's posterior. I tried desperately to time my bowel movements, knowing a guard would fetch the ammo box reserved for that purpose at 0800 hours. But the snarled fire hose of my bowels erupted at will, oftentimes right after the guard returned with the empty can. Liquids and solids then fermented for most of the night and day, a vile mixture rusting through the ammo box. But I had no right to complain, as my baby-faced guard told me. No one's picking up my shit every day, he said, peering at me through the slot in my iron door. But you're being waited on hand and foot, short of someone wiping your ass. What do you say to that? Thank you, sir. I could not call the guards comrade, the commandant demanding that I keep my history a secret lest it be leaked. The commissar orders this for your own protection, the commandant told me. The inmates will kill you if they know your secret. The only men who knew my secret were the commissar and the commandant, for whom I had developed feline feelings of both dependency and resentment. He was the one making me rewrite my confession with repeated strokes of his blue pencil. But what was I confessing to? I had done nothing wrong, except for being westernized. Nevertheless, the commandant was right. I was recalcitrant, for I could have shortened my unwanted stay by writing what he wanted me to write. Long live the party and the state. Follow Ho Chi Minh's glorious example. Let's build a beautiful and perfect society. I believed in these slogans, but I could not bring myself to write them. I could say that I was contaminated by the West, but I could not inscribe that on paper. It seemed as much of a crime to commit a cliché to paper as to kill a man, an act I had acknowledged rather than confessed. For killing Sonny and the crapulent major were not crimes in the commandant's eyes, but having nevertheless acknowledged what some might see as crimes, I could not then compound those deeds through my description of them. My resistance to the appropriate confessional style irritated the commandant, as he resumed telling me over dinner. "You Southerners had it too good for too long," he said. "You took beefsteak for granted, while we Northerners lived on starvation rations. We've been purged of fat and bourgeois inclinations, but you, no matter how many times you've rewritten your confession, cannot eradicate those inclinations. Your confession is full of moral weakness, individual selfishness, and Christian superstition. You exhibit no sense of collectivity, no belief in the science of history. You show no need to sacrifice yourself for the cause of rescuing the nation and serving the people." Another of Tohu's verses is appropriate here. "I'm a son of tens of thousands of families, a younger brother of tens of thousands of withered lives, a big brother to tens of thousands of little children who are homeless and live in constant hunger." Compared to Tohu, you are a communist in name only. In practice, you are a bourgeois intellectual. I'm not blaming you. It's difficult to escape one's class and one's birth, and you are corrupted in both respects. You must remake yourself, as Uncle Ho and Chairman Mao both said bourgeois intellectuals should do. The good news is that you show glimmers of collective revolutionary consciousness. The bad news is that your language betrays you. It is not clear, not succinct, not direct, not simple. It is the language of the elite. You must write for the people. You speak truthfully, sir, I said. The wood pigeon and manioc soup had begun dissolving in my stomach, the nutrients energizing my brain. I just wonder what you would say about Karl Marx, Comrade Commandant. Das Kapital isn't exactly written for the people. Marx did not write for the people? Suddenly I could see the darkness of the Commandant's cave through his magnified irises. Get out! See how bourgeois you are? A revolutionary humbles himself before Marx. Only a bourgeois compares himself to Marx. But rest assured, he will treat you for your elitism and Western inclinations. He has built a state-of-the-art examination room where he will personally supervise the final phase of your re-education, when you are transformed from an American into a Vietnamese once more. I am not an American, sir, I said. If my confession reveals anything, isn't it that I'm an anti-American? I must have said something outrageously humorous, for he actually laughed. The anti-American already includes the American, he said. Don't you see that the Americans need the anti-American? While it is better to be loved than hated, it is also far better to be hated than ignored. To be anti-American only makes you a reactionary. In our case, having defeated the Americans, we no longer define ourselves as anti-American. We are simply 100% Vietnamese. You must try to be as well. Respectfully speaking, sir, most of our countrymen do not think I am one of them. All the more reason for you to work harder to prove that you are one of us. Obviously, you think of yourself as one of us, at least sometimes, though you are making progress. I see you finish eating. What do you think of the wood pigeon? I admitted that it was delicious. What if I told you that wood pigeon is only a euphemism? He watched me carefully as I looked again at the pile of little bones on my plate, sucked clean of every bit of meat and tendon. Regardless of what it was, I still longed for another serving. Some call this rat, but I prefer field mouse, he said. But it hardly matters, does it? Meat is meat, and we eat what we must. Do you know I once saw a dog eating the brains of our battalion doctor? Ugh, I don't blame the dog. He was only eating the brains because the man's intestines had already been eaten by his fellow dog. These are the kinds of things you see on the battlefield. But losing all those men was worth it. All the bombs dropped on us by those air pirates were not dropped on our homeland. Not to mention that we liberated the Laotians. That is what revolutionaries do. We sacrifice ourselves to save others. Yes, Comrade Commandant. Enough serious talk. He threw the jute cover back over the pickled baby. I just wanted to give you my personal congratulations on having finished the written phase of your re-education, no matter how barely, in my opinion. You should be pleased with how far you've come, even if you should be critical yourself for the limitations so evident in your confession. As good a student as you are, you may yet become the dialectical materialist that the revolution needs you to be. Now, let us go meet the commissar. The commandant checked the time on his wristwatch, which also happened to have been my wristwatch. He is expecting us. We descended from the commandant's quarters and walked past the guard barracks to the stretch of flatland separating the two hills. My isolation cell was located here, one of a dozen of brick ovens, where we based it in our own juices, and where the prisoners tapped messages on the walls with tin cups. They had developed a simple code for communicating, and it was not long before they taught it to me. Part of what they conveyed to me was how they held me in high regard. Much of my heroic reputation came from Bon, who often greeted me through my neighbors. He and they believed I was singled out for extended isolation because of my ardent republicanism and my special branch credentials. They blamed the commissar for my fate, for he was really the one in charge of the camp, as everyone, including the commandant, knew. My neighbors had seen the commissar up close during his weekly political lectures, and the sight was truly horrific. Some cursed him, taking delight in his suffering. But the facelessness compelled respect among others, the mark of his dedication and sacrifice, even if for a cause that the prisoners despised. The guards, too, spoke of the faceless commissar with mixed tones of horror, fear, and respect, but never mockery. A commissar must never be mocked, even among one's peers, for one never knew when one of those peers might report such anti-revolutionary thinking. I understood the need for my temporary detention and marginal conditions, for the revolution must be vigilant, but what I could not understand, and what I hoped the commissar would explain, was why the guards feared him, and, more generally, why revolutionaries feared one another. "Aren't we all comrades?" I asked the commandant at an earlier session. "Yes," he said, "but not all comrades have the same level of ideological consciousness. Although I am not thrilled at having to seek the commissar's approval on certain matters, I also admit that he knows Marxist-Leninist theory and Ho Chi Minh thought much better than I ever will. I'm not a scholar, but he is. Men like him are guiding us toward a truly classless society. But we haven't eradicated all elements of anti-revolutionary thinking, and we must not forgive anti-revolutionary faults. We must be vigilant, even of each other, but mostly of ourselves. What my time in the cave taught me is that the ultimate life and death struggle is with ourselves. Foreign invaders might kill my body, but only I could kill my spirit. This is the lesson you must absorb by heart, which is why we give you so much time to achieve it." Ascending the hill toward the commissar's quarters, it seemed to me that I had already spent too much time learning that lesson. We stopped at the stairs leading up to his balcony, where the baby-faced guard and three other guards awaited. "The commissar is in charge of you now," the commandant said, inspecting me from head to toe with a frown. "I'll be frank. He sees much more potential in you than I do. You are addicted to the social evils of alcohol, prostitution, and yellow music. You write in an unacceptable, counter-revolutionary manner. You are responsible for the deaths of the Brew Comrade and the Watchman. You failed even in undermining this movie that misrepresents and insults us. If it were only up to me, I'd send you to the fields for your final cure. And if things do not work out with the Commissar, I still can. Remember that." "I will," I said, and, knowing that I had not yet escaped his power, I also said, "Thank you, Comrade Commandant, for all you have done for me. I know I've seemed reactionary to you because of my confession, but please believe me when I say that I have learned much under your tutelage and criticism." This, after all, was the truth. My show of gratitude mollified the Commandant. "Let me give you some advice," he said. "The prisoners tell me what they think I want to hear, but they don't understand that what I want to hear is sincerity. Isn't that what education is all about? Getting the student to sincerely say what the teacher wants to hear? Keep that in mind." With that, the commandant turned and began his descent down the hill, a man of admirably erect posture. "The commissar is waiting," the baby-faced guard said. "Let's go." I gathered what remained of myself. I was three-quarters of the man I used to be, according to the commandant's scale, manufactured in the USA and appropriated from a southern hospital. The commandant was obsessed with his weight and enamored with the scale's statistical precision. Through a rigorous longitudinal study of bowel movements, sampled from both guards and prisoners, including myself, the commandant had calculated that the camp's collective bowels issued about 600 kilos of waste per day. The prisoners collected and hand-carried this waste to the fields, where it served as fertilizer. Fecal precision was thus necessary for the scientific management of agricultural production. Even now, climbing the stairs ahead of the guards and knocking on the commissar's door, I felt the factory of my innards fashioning the wood pigeon into a solid brick that would be used tomorrow to help build the revolution. "Come in," said the commissar. That voice. His quarters consisted entirely of one big, rectangular room, as austere as the commandant's, with bamboo walls, bamboo floors, bamboo furniture, and bamboo rafters holding up a thatched roof. I had entered the sitting area, furnished with some low-slung bamboo chairs, a bamboo coffee table, and an altar on which sat Ho Chi Minh's gold-painted bust. Above his head hung a red banner imprinted with those golden words, "Nothing is more precious than independence and freedom." In the middle of the room was a long table stacked with books and papers, surrounded by chairs. Leaning against one of the chairs was a guitar with familiar curvaceous hips, and at one end of the long table was a record player that looked like the one I had left behind at the general's villa. At the far end of the room was a platform bed, draped in a cloud of mosquito netting, behind which a shadow stirred. The bamboo floor was cool under my bare feet, and the breeze, whispering through the open windows, caused the netting to tremble. A hand parted the netting, its skin burned to red, and he emerged from the bed's recesses. A visage of fearful asymmetry, I looked away. "Come now," the commissar said. "Am I really so horrible that you do not recognize me, my friend?" I looked back to see lips scorched away to reveal perfect teeth, eyes bulging from withered sockets, nostrils reduced to holes without a nose, the hairless, earless skull one massive keloid scar, leaving the head to resemble one of those dried, decapitated trophies swung on a string by an ebullient headhunter. He coughed, and a marble rattled in his throat. "Didn't I tell you," man said, "not to return?" Chapter 20. He was the commissar? Before I could say a word or make any sound at all, the guards seized me, gagged me, and blindfolded me. "You?" I wanted to scream, to shout into the darkness, but I could do no more than grunt and moan as they dragged me outside and down the hill, the blindfold scratchy, my arms pinioned, to a destination less than 100 paces away. "Open the door," the baby-faced guard said. Hinges creaked, and I was pushed from the open air into a confined, echoing space. "Arms up," the baby-faced guard said. I raised my arms. Someone unbuttoned my shirt and stripped it from me. Hands untied the string holding up my pants, and they dropped around my ankles. "Look at that," another guard said, whistling with admiration. "The bastard's big." "Not as big as me," a third guard said. "Let's see it then," the fourth guard said. "You'll see it when I fuck your mother with it." Perhaps more was said, but after someone with rough fingers inserted foam plugs into my ears, and someone else placed muffs of some kind on top of them, I heard nothing more. Deaf, dumb, and blind, I was pushed down onto a mattress. A mattress! I had slept on planks the past year. The guards strapped me down with ropes around my chest, thighs, wrists, and ankles, until I could do no more than wriggle my spread-eagled body. A foamy material was wrapped around my hands and feet, and a silky hood was pulled over my head, the softest fabric I had felt since Lana's lingerie. I stopped squirming, calming myself down so I could focus on my breathing through the hood. Then came vibrations of feet on the rough cement floor, followed by the faintest clank of the door being shut, and nothing more. Was I alone, or was someone watching me? I began sweating from the accumulating heat, rage, and fear, my sweat pooling under my back faster than the mattress could absorb it. My hands and feet were hot and clammy as well. A sudden sense of panic, of drowning, surged through me. I thrashed against my constraints and tried to scream, but my body would hardly move, and no sound emerged except a snuffle. Why was this being done to me? What did man want from me? Surely he would not let me die here. No. This was my final examination. I must calm down. This was only a test. I aced tests. The Oriental was a perfect student, the department chair had remarked more than once, and according to Professor Hammer, I had studied the best of what had been thought and said in Western civilization. Its torch passed on to me. I was my country's finest representative, Claude had assured me, a natural at the intelligence game. "Remember, you're not half of anything," my mother said. "You're twice of everything." Yes, I could pass this test, whatever it was, devised by a commissar who had been studying me and Bond for the past year. He had been reading my confession, even though he, unlike the commandant, already knew most of what was in it. He could have let us go, set us free. He could have told me he was a commissar. Why subject me to a year in isolation? My calm vanished, and I almost choked against my gag. "Calm down, breathe slowly." I managed to control myself once more. Now what? How would I pass the time? At least an hour must have elapsed since I was blindfolded, hadn't it? I longed to lick my lips, but with the gag in my mouth I almost vomited. That would be the death of me. When was he coming for me? How long would he leave me here? What had happened to his face? The guards would feed me, surely. On and on the thoughts came, the thousand cockroaches of time crawling over me until I shivered in agony and revulsion. I wept for myself then, and the tears under my blindfold had the unexpected benefit of clearing the dust from my mind's eye, enough for me to realize that I was not blind. My mind's eye could see, and what I saw was the